Thank you very much, and thank you very much to Ash and Phil for the invitation, for organising what I think has not only been a very ambitious but also instructive and potentially very important conference. I may be a professor of media and communications, but I'm a PowerPoint refuser, so it will just be me, yes, talking to you. So I'm going to take a slightly different approach, and John has actually very nicely set this up, talking about how the commons is undermined. And I do want to talk about the political commons and how it has been maybe in demise, maybe how it has a potential rebirth, and come to what Ash mentioned this morning about recovering the commons and recovering the political commons in particular. I should say that yesterday I did the Great North Run, and I'm slightly worried that not only did I leave my legs, but also my brain in South Shields. But I also want to say that I am a political activist as well. And this will colour my talk. And I always think it's necessary to say that. One of the biggest campaigns that I've been involved in recently is the Hacked Off campaign. And I am on the board of directors of Hacked Off. So I stake that up front, because I will be talking about that or I will refer to that in bits and pieces as I go through, partly because it's been incredibly instructive to me about how power is in place in transnational media corporations, and also how commons is undermined in that way, and particularly the political commons is undermined. So I'll be referring to that, but I'm not focusing on that in the main. What I want to focus on is what keeps me awake at night, and that's really about the worry, some of the things that John referred to that now has given me new cause to stay awake at night, but that notion of how do we counter that? How do we develop, particularly in the UK, a meaningful left politics, a progressive force? What are the possibilities then for a politics in common within the context of the research that I do around digitalisation and that kind of digital neoliberal age? We know that this neoliberal age presents huge challenges. We've heard about many of them today. And I think in my work, what that points to is how the key foundations, really, of a liberal democracy are actually being polluted and eroded with alarming alacrity. Most recently, I'm sure many of you have read Piketty's study. We've all read the issues and criticisms of that. What I think he did demonstrate is that neoliberalism has steered a resolute path to wealth concentration, inequality, impoverishment, unrivaled since the late 19th century. And, you know, in John's trajectory, this will carry on and on and on, and it will just get worse. That damage is not only socioeconomic, of course, but also extends to a limited range of political ideologies that stabilise those relations. And media institutions, it will come as no surprise, I think are implicated in this pattern of erosion, a subject and object of economic restructuring that favours elites, both through sustained messages that legitimate that upward transfer and concentration of property and wealth, and through the deregulation and privatisation of media, thereby arguably placing the media out of reach of democratically organised political will formation. And that becomes a major problem. So as party politics shifts to a consumer style of representation and participation in parliamentary democratic elections declines, we face a critical disjuncture, I think, in a deep and multifaceted crisis of our representative democratic system, a system long regarded as weakened by the competitive imperatives of economic globalisation and the declining counterpower of organised labour in the diminishment of the trade union movement. Similarly, as political parties chase popularity and rely, understandably but somewhat misguidedly, on mainstream news coverage to capture and persuade potential voters. So we find a shrinking range and register of party political action and conceivable alternative political projects and policy interventions. Meanwhile, the increased power of corporations and transnational financial agencies over public priorities continues unabated, despite the evident damage writ large for all to see in the global economic crisis. Few corporations are actually more powerful than the transnational media corporations epitomised in the likes of the Murdoch Empire that has wrested the idea of news from democracy and the public interest in order to chase audiences and sales, reproducing sameness and market populism. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through. But I think John's reference to that notion of offshoring as getting round rules, escape and avoidance of responsibility, it's very, very reminiscent to me of much that was uncovered through the Leveson inquiry and the hacking scandal. And it's also, thinking of some of the talks earlier today, that notion of, the filming of the Leveson inquiry, the hacking scandal, that law as performance there, and the massive disjuncture between a legal team on the Murdoch side of, literally dozens of barristers at millions and millions of pounds worth of legal advice, as opposed to the CPS single barrister with their one assistant trying to counter all of that in that sort of the way in which law was performed in front of us in throughout that whole process. In this context, which is not just a figment of my own nightmares, exactly how progressive political values of a politics in common are forged, moderated, and channeled into concrete practices, I think is one of the critical political questions of our time. And I should say from the outset, and this does link nicely with John's talk, is that in talking about a notion of a politics in common, I am linking that very much to the concept and practice of democracy. And I'll talk a little bit about what this thing called democracy might mean in a moment. So in a situation where liberal democracy is broken, I would argue, governments no longer carry out manifesto pledges, trust in politicians is at an all-time low, elite interests prevail, where the political system no longer works for the mass of ordinary people, what Colin Crouch refers to as a post-democracy. It's in that context that I'm thinking of how we might recover a political commons. And this is not only manifest in unworkable political systems of liberal representative democracy, but also in our ideological imaginations. And I think that is also crucial. Wendy Brown goes as far as to argue that, and this is a quote, "What is unprecedented about this time is the extent to which basic principles and institutions of democracy are becoming nothing other than ideological shells concealing their opposite. That is, where non-market moralities have been displaced by a thoroughgoing market rationality that leaves us with the residues of old-fashioned democracy inside the legitimation project of neoliberalism." And this has led others, such as Boltanski and Ciapello, to argue that processes of valuation, and I'm very interested in that notion of political values at the moment, via the logic of capital, albeit in a range of different guises, are now the predominant method for understanding the social world. So it's making a link here between that notion of political value and values and the political commons. And that raises a critical question for the left regarding the extent to which the logic of capital has subsumed political values and a politics in common. Where do we go from there? Have values such as collectivism and the common good been evacuated of meaning? Does capital always win out? And when it doesn't, what is particular to the circumstances and histories of cases that Bev Skeggs says obstruct capital's lines of flight? The media, I think, play a key role in the communication of all things political. Mainstream journalism has been shown to be susceptible to capital as value and the corrosion of politics in common. In particular, much research has demonstrated that the deregulation and privatisation of the media has had deleterious consequences, particularly in relation to mainstream news and journalism, in the public interest and for the public good. I'm just going to very quickly refer to some of that research, because I know that you don't all come or read about media necessarily. The Spaces of News project that I was part of within Goldsmiths Leverhulme Media Research Centre was one of the first of its kind to investigate how new media is impacting upon news in the current kind of neoliberal economic configuration. It found that news media and newspapers in particular are in crisis. Again, you will have heard about this, but newspaper circulation has declined sharply, advertising revenue has migrated to online sites, the business model has broken. Digitization has increased the speed of news reporting, while websites created by newspapers to fend off competition require more space to be filled. So news organizations have responded by cutting staff while expecting those who remain to file more stories in less time, resulting often in the cannibalization of news from online sites. And sadly, I have to tell you that that cannibalization is often from the Daily Mail to other sites. The outcome has generally been a journalism that's shallower and faster and increasingly homogenous. Meanwhile, of course, in the blogosphere, other actors have made their own views known, adding to an abundance of comment and analysis. However, these voices have often found it increasingly difficult to be heard. And consequently, far from extending the range of voices and debates, we found that news in the digital age, despite the best efforts of many great bloggers and many committed journalists, it actually reproduces the same that same old sameness and chimes again with the logic of capital. And one of the references I like says that something like 10% of people on Twitter generate 90% of Twitter's content, and that 10% tend to be elite, either mainstream news organizations themselves or celebrities. So again, you know, this is not some great nirvana of open communication. So this has profound implications, not only for the range of information at our regular disposal, but also for the type of political values that are given credence and volume, and the potential flattening of political values embedded in everyday life in a digital neoliberal age, reminiscent of Mark Fisher's notion of capitalist realism. But if we only understand the world from the perspective of the reproduction of the logic of capital, what do we miss noticing or misrecognize politically? We know there have also been big attempts to create spaces protected from the colonization by capital calculation, alternative spaces for progressive political voices that many of us could point to, and we've heard some of them today, but one obvious one to point to might be the Occupy movement, and I'll refer a little bit to that in a moment. So not all content online is similar. Who would ever seek to claim that? It's not all similar. And much digital content also provides the means not only to legitimate, but to challenge, resist, and counter the hegemony of a neoliberal political economic order. And so we also found, as part of this research, new forms of circulation of information that sometimes constitute alternative bids for political meaning and value, swimming against the riptide of global capitalism and seeking to establish politics in common. In every manifestation, the internet is central to an understanding of the contemporary representation and articulation of politics in common through the circulation of political values and enactments of political belief. Not only have the spaces for political engagement expanded in a digital media scape, but our orientation has changed towards them too. And I often speak about a new means and a new meaning of being political in an online age. So the meta-narratives of a politics of old, organized around unifying ideologies such as socialism and communism, are being replaced with a more sort of post-foundational politics, in Marshart's words, that correspond, seemingly, to the hybridity, reflexivity, mobility, and performativity characteristic of network society. A post-foundational politics is critical of those who view the field of political practices as separate from culture and the economy, arguing instead that network technologies accelerate, intensify, and hybridize political, cultural, and economic practices to configure and produce new political spaces, fronts, and opportunities, producing assemblages of power in often unpredictable ways that we're only just beginning to grasp. And I'm sure you all know of commentators have referred to this, most famously probably Manuel Castells, who argues that our creative autonomy from capital is being unleashed via new cultures of sharing and co-production that can sidestep, rebut, and ultimately, he claims, undermine global capitalism. Such places of counterpolitics in common are important for a left politics that has always relied to a certain extent on the notion of the collective, the ability and will of the people to come together, organize, and construct a collective politics for the general good against an individualist and corporate agenda. But the question still remains unanswered as to how these multifarious publics that constitute such a commons are actually generated, come together, and effect social change. The internet and social media have also, of course, been criticized very heavily for bringing forth an era of an easy come, easy go politics, where you're only ever one click away from a petition, a technological form that encourages issue drift, whereby individuals shift focus from one topic to another, one website to another, with little commitment or even thought. That click and link politics, which is also easy to do and leaves a warm glow at the end of it. Where collective political identity may have a memory that's actually short-lived and easily deleted. Where Googlearchy prioritizes commercial sites and concentrates power and authority, it's a quote from Jeremy Gilbert, at particular privileged nodes, corporate headquarters, hedge funds, media outlets, and so on, giving capital actually ever more structural advantage. What impact might this have on the politics in common? One, when considered alongside, and again, this is Jeremy Gilbert, the individualizing logic of contemporary consumer culture and much of public policy that's indicative of a certain abstract continuity with the forms of individualization typical of industrial modernity, and is the first obstacle which any attempt to realize collective power of any kind must overcome. So it's a claim, a bid, if you like, to deeply contextualize all of those claims, the counterclaims that are made for a counterpolitics. Against that sort of backdrop, it's at least clear that the mediation of politics in common raises crucial concerns that require an interrogation of the ways in which the mechanics of neoliberalism work to inhibit the emergence of any political collectivity whatsoever. But we should also take account of a broader historical context where I think the residues of the redistributive politics of the welfare state in the UK, combined with the affective dimensions of counter-political network communication that may also enable empathy and care, promote egalitarian policies, minister to mutual recognition, and expand cooperation and collaborative working, extending to corners where capital has yet to reach. So in that kind of complex interweaving of structure and agency mixed with history and mixed with some hopeful imaginings of the future, I begin from an understanding of politics in common as a politics with democratic desires, purposes, and designs that our current political system falls far short of. Although democratic desires, purposes, and designs are based on many contending factors, depending on the particular democratic formation proposed, with maybe liberal, direct, participatory models being the most commonly referred to, I think there are certain features that we can point to that remain key to any analysis of politics in common in the digital age. And I'm going to look at just three of those for the rest of this paper. And three that I've kind of plucked out of the air, really. I'm sure there are many others that we could turn to, but three that seem particularly relevant to me. And one of the three, maybe you can guess at the end, I'm still not that sure about. Mutual recognition is one, equality another, and cooperation the third. So let's go to look again at this in terms of mutual recognition. So I want to think through the notion of a digital political commons alongside a politics of difference and mutual recognition. You will all know of the work of Nancy Fraser, who famously wrote about the importance of recognition for a democratic politics. Fraser cites Taylor, who wrote, "Non-recognition or misrecognition can be a form of oppression, imprisoning someone in a false, distorted, reduced mode of being. Beyond simple lack of respect, it can inflict a grievous wound, saddling people with crippling self-hatred. Due recognition is not just a courtesy, but a vital human need." This became particularly sort of pertinent to me working on the hacking campaign. That became particularly key as I was dealing with kind of victims of the hacking scandal. Others, notably Honneth and Iris Marion Young, have said similar things. "For Honneth, we gain our integrity of self from the receipt of approval or recognition of others. So non-recognition or misrecognition in, say, the mainstream media, are, Fraser claims, cultural injustices hugely damaging to our political and social selves." But then we also have the internet, not absolved, of course, from circulating misrecognition. In fact, endlessly circulates misrecognition, raising very interesting debates currently over the right to be forgotten in particular forms, but also able to offer recognition where mainstream media may fail, misrepresentative, or simply fall short. As such, the internet is at the heart of that radical politics. It's galvanized local campaigning, it's facilitated transnational political movements, bringing forth the potential for political commons at an unprecedented level. And I do think it's potential. These activities combine collective action and individual subjectivities, mixing personal expressions of political allegiance with public debate, in an online context that's enabled the spaces of action and debate to expand from local and national configurations and terrestrial media to global counter-summits and the internet. And one of the striking differences between the politics of many transnational social movements and a traditional counter-politics of the nation-state is the rejection of broad, unifying meta-narratives of organization, such as socialism or communism, and the forging of a commons on an altogether different grounds that actually is at pains to emphasize diversity over universality and refuses to be identified by a party name or definitive ideology. It is actually a politics that in many ways is well suited to that click and link culture of the internet and is characterized by rapid change in form, approach, and mission. Such forms of oppositional politics may be based in, but spread quickly beyond specific localities. They're usually based on a principle of non-hierarchy, with open protocols, open communication, self-generating information and identities that function via networks of activism and activists. They're often staunchly anti-bureaucratic and anti-centralist, suspicious of large, organized, formal, and institutional politics. Furthermore, the ability of new communication technologies to operate globally and respond to global economic agendas from a variety of contingent social and political contexts signals a potentially limitless diversity of online voices, with the possibility of coalescing at key protest events while emanating from contexts that may be starkly divergent. Is this a political commons writ large? Despite the variability and fluidity at the heart of these forms of radical politics that embrace difference, they are, it's claimed, they would claim, founded on commonality, but consciously distinct from a class labour configuration of a solidarity of old. Participants in these networks are drawn together by common elements in value systems and political understandings, though they may be very capricious and liable to frequent change. It's a politics that makes a virtue out of a commons built on a value of difference that goes beyond a simple respect for otherness and involves an inclusive politics of voice. Many commentators have claimed that the space of new media enables a broader range of voices and types of material to be communicated to a wider audience without the constraints of needing to comply with or follow a particular political creed or direction, other than the expression of an affinity with a particular cause or acknowledgement of a shared empathy for the consequences of democratic deficit, regardless of the contextual differences of how that's actually experienced. It's a politics, in many ways, that has been typified by the likes of the Occupy movement. And what was so striking about Occupy as a movement was its attempts within that politics, that inclusive politics of difference, to conceive, to rethink how democracy may function within that particular disorganisation, shall we say. Disillusioned with systems of representative democracy, it set about experimenting with new forms of doing politics in common, developing new forms of democracy. If you've ever tried to do it, is an incredibly painful and difficult task, but one that was sought via the daily assemblies within the Occupy movement. Is anybody here involved in Occupy? No. If you were, you would have gone along to a daily meeting called the People's Assembly or General Assembly, where people gathered to deliberate and take decisions based upon collective agreement or consensus, although consensus was an interesting disputed term amongst them as well. There was no leader or governing body of the Assembly, as it operated with a real, genuine desire for equality of voice and mutual recognition. Individual political autonomy was central to the practice of the Assembly, where the aim was to bring many singularities of viewpoints together in a consensus that could be expressive of the differences it embodied. It was incredibly painful, actually, as a process, but incredibly interesting. And it's suggestive, I think, of what Jean-Luc Nancy has described as a truly political community, what that might look like. Political, this is Nancy, would mean a community ordering itself to the unworking of its communication, or destined to this unworking, a community consciously undergoing the experience of its sharing. In other words, an active and dynamic form of political co-production, whereby all participants engage in a constant and ongoing dialogue. Now, you know, that you think of that notion that what would democracy look like? It would look like an endless meeting. You know, people have said that endless, ongoing, painful meeting that we're all trying to avoid in our academic lives. The Occupy movement, of course, resonates with the work of Heart and Agree, and this was spoken about this morning. They've attempted to broach this politics of multitude and become, in the process, a source of validation and direction for many people in these counter-globalisation movements. They propose a description of the multitude as an open network of singularities that links people together on the basis of the common they share and the common they produce, a union that doesn't subordinate in any way or erase the radical differences among those singularities. In other words, because of its plurality and the sharing of life in common, controlled by capital, the multitude contains the composition they claim of true democracy. And there's been many critiques of this. Their notion of a new science of democracy is incredibly difficult to pin down. Exactly how it would function is never really very well articulated. Laclau famously called the approach of Hart and Negri the antithesis of politics, an agency that does not articulate, represent, or strategize, a utopia without architecture, a universality without meaning. But new forms of architecture do take time to evolve and must constantly struggle against the dominant narratives of neoliberal rationality to make headway. Nonetheless, I think there is a very real risk of appearing to fetishize expression and participation without being able to deliver political solutions that might be necessary to reimagine democracy in any actually lived way. Then to move briefly on to talk about politics in common but vastly unequal, because I think equality is key, and maybe I'll skirt over this because so many people have referred to the notion of equality as being so fundamental to the notion of the commons. And I don't think the commons is necessarily synonymous with equality, but I do think it's crucial as an ethical underpinning for any political commons, and I always refer to the work of Wilkinson and Pickett and their very seminal work, which linked levels of inequality and poverty to a whole host of social and political issues and concerns. Less well cited is a report by Michael Forster of the OECD called Divided We Stand, who notes that in the UK, 65% of people say that inequality is too high, yet at the same time, they vastly underestimate its extent, which I think is very interesting. Poverty and the poor suffer constant non-recognition in the mass media, and this has a massive negative political consequence. And as Tyler has recently argued, increased inequality has been accompanied by the heightened stigmatization in political discourse of disposable populations, to the extent that stigmatization operates as a form of governance which legitimizes the reproduction and entrenchment of inequalities and injustices. And in the paper itself, what I go on to do is link that politics of inequality and sort of economic inequality in particular to a whole range of political failings and political systems, such that the ways in which new public policies are devised are done to massively favour those people who still choose to vote as against those who have become, who are now declining to vote, such that we have what Gottfried, Birch and Lodge have called a toxic situation, where only a third of under 35-year-olds earning £10,000 or less bothered to vote in 2010, compared with almost 80% of over 55s earning £40,000 or more. And we have a UK government who delivers average voters a loss of 12%, while average non-voters had a loss of 20%. So there we have where the most disillusioned with the current political system get poorer and ever more disenfranchised, and those increasing inequalities lead to ever more vastly impoverished democracies. But of course, inequality is not only economic. Research on the digital divide notes that internet users are younger, more highly educated and richer than non-users still, more likely to be men than women, more likely to live in cities, and similar findings of the wealth of wealth and privilege have been found to apply to digital activists. The digital activists themselves follow these patterns of privilege and inequality. Those concerns don't just refer to access to the internet and the huge gaps prevalent between the global north and south. They also refer to online activity within developed nations and traditional divides between well-educated middle class who dominate public discourse online as well as offline, and those on the peripheries or excluded altogether. Tom Patterson has some very nice research on this, where he talks about how actually we're becoming entirely ghettoized, where we have political junkies online who spend their life, as many of you in this room will do, like I do, endlessly checking up on any possible website on anything political or what's happening, and those that actually will be far more regularly distracted and linked, as again many of us in this room will be, to those tasty tidbits of information that take us to celebrity gossip sites and stuff down the side of the online news websites. So what we have to do is endlessly deal with that constant encroachment of the material consequences of inequality offline and online. A politics in common may well emanate from inequality, but does the digital age further disguise and disable a politics in common, increasingly preserved for the privileged? And finally, I want to end with talking about cooperation. And that's, I want to think about, cooperation is often referred to as being very, very much part of an online existence, a co-production, cooperative, working with each other in a very participatory way, a progressive networked politics. Or the question is, are we, again, just simply in collusion with a networked capitalism? The likes of Occupy have attempted to deal with this notion of cooperation through the embodiment of a philosophy and practice that sort of mirrors a networked culture, the notion of horizontalism. Horizontalism brings with it a commitment, at least in principle, to direct democracy, an absolute participation in every decision. It's pure cooperation based on a co-production that seeks to change the nature of social relations within political organizing. And this is, of course, not new. Doreen Massey has noted the feminist movement was premised on the deep scrutiny of the operation of power relations and hierarchies on which the organizations of the left was based, and actually many meetings that I go to now around these new political and social movements actually are very reminiscent to me of kind of feminism throughout the late 70s and 80s. The problem here is that the principle is one thing and actually the practice is quite another. And direct democracy is feels feasible with 12 people, it may feel feasible with 120 or maybe even thousands. But actually, with millions, absolute shared decision-making is simply not possible. Digital networks are seen by some as the purveyors of such a politics in common, but these are networks that are as structured by capital as any other form of communication and come with their own warning stickers. Are they collective politics, or rather simply a connective politics? And what's the difference there, and how does that substantively change the politics that we're working with? Do they encourage creative autonomy or consumer individualism? Do they build the commons or entrench capitalism? And maybe they do all of these things at once. And Bennett and Sagerberg's work on social media and social movements looks very closely at that, and shows how the heavily personalized means of communicating protest online does lead to a connective rather than collective response that may well limit rather than extend political possibilities. And as Aletta Norvell reminds us, it's a nice little quote from her, we have to avoid assuming the existence of a framework of politics in which in principle every voice could be heard, without giving attention to the very structuring of those frameworks and the ways in which the visibility of subjects is structured. The wider framings, back to me, of the social order, the broader context of values and ideas in which social movements circulate, have to be taken into account materially, socially, culturally, before any assessments of politics in common are made. So what I want to do as part of this discussion and wrapping up is sort of point to, yes, the enormous benefits of political activities that occur online are now greatly facilitated by digital media. I'm not denying that in any way. But the tendency to elide networked politics with the politics in common relegates the importance of structural inequalities that impinge on all our political practices. And in its poorest manifestation, that descends into clicktivism, signing online petitions, writing dissenting blogs, sending political tweets that, as Jody Dean has argued, are fully recuperable in a context where, and a quote from her, rhetorics of access, participation, and democracy work ideologically to secure the technological infrastructure of neoliberalism, an invidious and predatory political economic project that concentrates assets and power in the hands of the very, very rich, devastating the planet and destroying the lives of billions of people. So finally, what should a politics in common do? It's a very big question. I think we, but I do think we've pointed at some of that today. It should, and I can't remember who, forgive me, it's late now, but somebody did speak about bringing publics into being. It needs to do that. Diverse assemblies of a body politic who want to reimagine what democracy could be. That has to be crucial for a politics in common. How social relations can be imagined differently, how we can live together better, co-productively, cooperatively. And, you know, there are many people who have pointed to this, and I'm not saying that that should be, you know, that's just a nice, comfortable world where we all like each other. Far from it. This should be a, you know, it should be on the basis of dissension and friction and interruption. Should be quite the opposite of comfortable. A real democracy constantly recreates and is constantly challenged and opposed. Network communication allows these desires to be shared and empathy to develop. It allows the possibilities of cooperation to be felt, and I do think that's important. So that notion of feeling that there is somebody out there who feels the same as you, feeling a shared politics, allows new political spaces to open up. And I think that's important stuff. Having that sense of feeling of possibility. One of the things I am very aware of with the whole hacking campaign and the Hacked Off campaign that I'm heavily working with is that actually it feels like it is now more possible to speak out against some of those corporations in a way that really didn't happen before. So that people are actually now shouting back and saying, you know what, that is actually wrong. What they've printed there is wrong, and I'm going to tell everybody that this is wrong and that this. And actually, a few years ago, that didn't happen. And so that in itself is a very important move. It extends the range of political possibilities. The question then becomes, how can multiple commons achieve a sufficient consensus in order to make possible the exercise of power and citizen participation? And I think we've kind of spoken about power today, but not really. We haven't really got our teeth stuck into that. It requires organisation, it requires institution making, it requires engagement with actually existing left politics, those accused of bureaucratic sellout. How can these commons, defined by their multitude, premised on their difference, come together and forge, and this is a term I quite like, there's many of them around, but Dussel's term, a critical democracy, a democracy based on real participation of all publics, as equals in a new political order. And I think that does require recognition, mutual recognition, it requires equality, and it requires cooperation among many other things. As critical theorists and researchers, I think there's no more urgent project, as this conference has well shown, than reimagining this politics in common.